Thank you very much. I had a chance to go around and greet several of you, but if I didn't get a chance to say hello and welcome. So anyway, and my apologies, as I was typing, I typed a typo there. I know it's CLU. My typewriter, my fingers didn't quite know that. So anyway, I wanted to let you know. As she mentioned, I'm from, right now, a California native, born and bred, very proud of that, but it's a case of California girl gone south. I've lived in Greensboro, North Carolina for the last 8 years, going on 9 years. And I have to say that I do like it in Greensboro, but my home is here. My home is in California. As a matter of fact, I still have a house in Northern California, so I pay my share of taxes to California as well. So. Anyway, she mentioned that I do work right now for the Center for Creative Leadership. How many of you know about the Center for Creative Leadership? Well, let me tell you a little bit, and to also let you know that the book that you received is a gift courtesy of the Center for Creative Leadership. The Center is an organization that's been around for about 38 years or so. It's founded in 1970. And it's an organization whose primary purpose is to provide leadership development training to business executives, corporate CEOs, business leaders, education leaders, not-for-profit leaders. And we do this throughout the world. The center has been recognized for the last 10 years by Business Week and the Financial Times, the Singapore Financial Times, so on and so forth, as one of the top leaders of leadership development outside of universities. And so this is work that they've been doing for quite a while. I've shared this with a couple of people already, but I think even though you didn't raise your hand saying that you knew the Center for Creative Leadership, you know the Center for Creative Leadership. Let me tell you how you know the Center for Creative Leadership. When you were young and you had a cold, your mom or your grandmom or maybe your dad went in and got some salve and put it on your chest. What was that? Vicks Vapor Rub, exactly. Vicks, that is the foundation for the Center for Creative Leadership. Our founders were the family that, the Smith-Richardson family, that actually, manufactured good old Vicks Vapor Rub, and the Center for Creative Leadership right now is actually situated on the family farm. So, and what they believed a long time ago, that leaders are not born, leaders are made. And that the way that you can do that is through really tapping in and trying to identify those things that really are making a difference. You also are familiar with the center because of some of the work that's come out of the center, because the center is part delivery and part research. And so 360-degree feedback, which is so many of you are familiar, actually was pioneered at the Center for Creative Leadership. The other thing is that how many of you are familiar or have read the research on breaking the glass ceiling? Okay, then the research, I still work alongside the women that wrote that research. So you do know the center in a way. We have campuses in Greensboro, North Carolina, like I said, the family farm. It looks a lot better than the family farm, though. We also have a campus in Colorado Springs. We have a campus in San Diego. Our Asian campus is in Singapore, and our European campus is located in Brussels. And our president just got back 3 weeks ago, opening a new campus in Russia. And he was in Moscow, and we have a campus that we are forming in India as well. So we really are a global company. And what I do there at the center is that I lead the work that the center does, working with educators and not-for-profits. So working primarily with those that are in formal leadership positions, so superintendents, principals, aspiring principals, and then over the last 4 or 5 years been working with senior leadership at colleges and universities. So so I do that, and the other time I do is I play around with consulting and working with the people that are most important to me, and that's really people that are working in the trenches in leadership. So that's a little bit about me. So let's find out who's in the room here. How many teachers in the room? All right, then. How many principals? Assistant principals. Okay, then. Counselors. All right, then. Higher ed professors. All right. Higher ed staff. Okay, then. Doctoral students. Yeah, I've had to check to see whether or not, as I said, a few of you don't know why you're here tonight. You know what you're supposed to be doing. Anyway, but very glad you're here. Master's in education. Master's in counseling. Let's see, who else did I miss? Alumni. Anybody else that I didn't mention? Who else? Spouses, significant others. All right, that you are here. All right, well, let me tell you a little bit about what we're going to do for the next hour or so. We're going to talk about this whole idea of intuition and what I refer to as intuitive leadership. And so, as you said here, what I want to do is I want to give you exposure to a little bit of practical research. Also want to talk to you about really that's important are some real-life examples. So examples that are cited in the book, some examples that are things that have actually happened to me, but most importantly, things that are happening to you in terms of intuition, intuitive leadership, and really apply what Jackie and I, when we wrote the book, what we think really is the core of intuitive leadership, and that has to do with environmental readings and files from the past. So we're going to talk about intuitive ways of knowing, some leader behaviors, some communication, and then kind of looking at some contradictions of leadership. So that's what we've got planned for this evening. I've been doing professional development for a long time, and this is the time in the presentation that you're supposed to stop, and you're supposed to check in with people and make sure that it's really meeting their needs and really meeting their expectations. And what I'm going to tell you right now, get over it. We're moving on. All right. I want to begin with a definition of intuition, or at least the definition that we use, and that it really is about what Nancy Rosenoff said. She said it's about when you know something without knowing you know it. It's about that internal system that's part association, a little bit of memory, it's part experience, and it's even part unknown there. I want to start off with a story actually from the book, and I want to begin with this one. A principal is walking the halls and sees two female students sitting on the floor outside of a classroom. Both have pencils in hand and appear to be doing work. The principal has not had any prior interaction with the students and assumes that they're in the hall because of a class project. The principal acknowledges them with a nod and proceeds on. Later that day, two male students are sitting outside the same classroom again with pencils in hand and appearing to be doing work. This time, the principal assumes that they are there because of a discipline matter and decides to question them. Now, what some people might say, well, maybe that's a little gender bias there. Some people might even say, well, was there something that gave off? But for some way, the principal knew that these were students that she needed to stop. So why is it that she knew? How is it that she knew? Well, what we think about is that a lot of it has to do with this whole idea of intuition. Think about a time when you knew something without knowing how you knew it. Think about a time when your internal system told you that something was going on and really it was hard for you to explain it. If you got a pen and a paper, I'd like you to jot down a couple of key words. If you don't have a pen and a paper, or you choose not to have a pen and a paper, jot these things down in your head. Then what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to turn to the person sitting next to you, and I want you to share your story. Now, I would like the story shared in pairs, maximum trios, but no more than that because I'm not going to give you that much time. So I'm going to give you about 5 minutes total. So if it's a trio, talk fast. If it's a duo, you have about 2.5 minutes apiece. But after jotting down those keywords, if you would turn to the person sitting next to you, and I would like you to tell the story, much like the story that I told about the principal. Ready? Go. Thank you. Okay, if we could come back together as a whole. Recognizing that you probably have more stories to tell, and you're going to get opportunities to tell them. I want to give you just a little bit about what this intuition is. I remember when we first started, people said, so is this like, ooh, or are you, is this some crystal ball or tarot cards or anything? It's none of that. What Jackie and I found, because we were former principals, and people would ask us all the time, especially I can remember an assistant principal saying, Karen, how do you know? How do you know to walk over to that group of students and not walk over to that one? You know, how is it that you know that you needed to stop in that classroom at that time? Or how did you know that you needed to go someplace else? And my response all the time was, I don't know. And what we looked at is we kept saying, so what is that? And so there were two things that seemed to keep surfacing. And the first one had to do with environmental readings, being able to really sense what was going on in the environment and being in tune to what's going on. So what are the who's and the what's and the where's and the when's, but being having your sentence heightened to the things that are going on. So that so a lot of times the intuition is because your senses are really in tune with what's going on around you. So it's not just the 180, it's actually the 380. So it is feeling and sensing the things that are going on. The second thing that we recognize, it has a lot to do with files from the past. Our bodies are just enormous data banks. I mean, every cell in our body remembers. It remembers things that happened to us when we were infants, all the way to things that are happening to us even right now. And all of these are stored in our bodies. So a lot of times that when we're being intuitive or we're using our intuition, something about we're not sure how this happened, it's happening because our bodies remember. And so that was one of the things that we found out. So it's not just the secret. It really is about things that have happened to us in the past, and as well as those environmental readings. And as shared right here with this quote, it says, you know, if you're willing to become more conscious of your own beliefs and the alternatives you're intuitively aware of, you can begin to see that to a great extent, your life as it is now is the result of choices that you made in the past, and that your future will evolve according to the choices you're making now. Making choices for your own growth, trusting your intuition, really can become a habit. So using your intuition is something that you can do a lot and all the time. And trust that it's right. Trust that your intuition is right, because it very much is. It has to do with the environmental readings, and it has to do with those files from the past. Frances Vaughn and Marcia Emery talked about what they talked about are like five levels of intuitive input, and just want to talk to you a little bit about each one of them. We get this input in terms of files from the past and environmental readings. Sometimes it comes in the form of things that happen to you physically. You know, the physical thing that all of a sudden you get the little tingling in the hands, you get the butterflies in the stomach, you get the all of a sudden little kind of ringing going on. There's something, the hair stands on the end. All of those have to do with this idea of, files from the past and environmental readings, but sometimes it really has to do with physical, the things that are going on in your body there. I talk about in the book about a principal who said that physically, I think it was an assistant principal that said physically, if he had to sleep until the alarm went off, then he could almost be guaranteed that it was not going to be a good day. If he could wake up even 5 minutes, 3 minutes before the alarm went off, for some reason his day went well. But if he had to sleep until the alarm went off, then it was like, oh no, who's going to be waiting for me there? But it's just that whole idea of maybe the physical there. The mind has to do with the ahas. Sort of the ideas that sort of comes to me all of a sudden. You really aren't sure how it came to you, but it just came to you, and you're just saying, I get this. I really get this. And I think I'm trying to think about the example that I used for the book, The Going Off, is that it's where, you know, seemingly disparate pieces of the puzzle just sort of come together all of a sudden, and you're not even sure why that's going on there. And we know that we have a reservoir of a lot of memories. We have a reservoir of lots of creativity, but it's in a lot of cases it really is located, you know, very subconsciously. I cite in the book this one. A teacher claimed that a teacher had gotten angry and out of the sight of witnesses had actually struck him. The teacher calmly denied the accusation and reminded the dean that the student had been reprimanded for lying in the past. The dean went on to relate that he, you know, confronted the teacher out of the presence of the student with a simple statement. I know that Jeffrey is not lying, so why don't you tell me about what really happened? And the teacher eventually admitted that acting out of frustration, he had hit the teacher. Hit the student. And when asked how, the teacher asked, how did you know that I was not the one telling the truth? The dean just said, I knew. The truth just popped into my head. And sometimes the popping in your head, that is the mental thing that goes on there. In terms of the emotional are those immediate dislike or immediate like, an immediate attraction, knowing, it's the immediate connections that go on there. This one was, you know, I knew from the moment I saw the application there was another candidate with similar background and even more experience. I just knew that Doreen would be a better complement to me and my style, and it's 5 years later and I'm still feeling the same way. So it just kind of comes to you. There is also an input that has to do with the emotional in terms of, you know, it could be like a romantic element. This one is one that actually happened to me. I was at a job fair, and I was interviewing, I don't know how many candidates. And I interviewed two candidates, and they were, and I remember saying, gosh, they'd be a cute couple. And I ended up hiring both of them. They were very good. Well, 2 years later, I was the one that gave the first toast at their wedding. I have no idea how this happened, but that it did, and it did happen there. So with the physical, the mental, it's popping in your head, the emotional, where there's immediate connection are going on there. There's also the spiritual, and the spiritual having to be that there's some higher power. I know that there's some higher power at work. And I don't know why, I don't know what's going on, but there's something bigger than me. And that bigger than me is leading me or telling me or giving me messages about things. And this one was another one that we shared. After serving quite successfully as an assistant superintendent for more than 5 years, a 38-year-old colleague was a shoo-in for the superintendency. She was endorsed by both the teachers and the classified employees' unions and by the retiring superintendent. Informal conversations with Board of Trustees members indicated that the position would not be advertised and that it would be offered to this assistant. Shortly before the official announcement, the assistant telephoned the board president and told her that she would not be available to accept the position because she had recently signed up for a 2-year stint in the Peace Corps. And what she said is that in her letter, she said, recently I announced that I accepted a 2-year position in the Peace Corps. I'm excited about this new venture and ask that you keep me in your thoughts and prayers. Having grown up professionally in this district, serving as a teacher and a principal and an assistant superintendent, I'm both honored and humbled that so many of you endorsed me and were behind me in terms of this position. I'm not taking this endorsement lightly, yet having been blessed with so many gifts in my life, caring friends, supportive family, meaningful work, and good health, I've decided to take a temporary hiatus from a life and a career that have brought me so much joy to work with others that they may have the opportunity to create a similar reality for themselves. I have not turned my back on the students, the parents, the teachers, or the staff of this wonderful school community. Rather, the lessons I've learned from all of you are helping to propel me towards this new phase in my life. We are all called to serve in different capacities as a parent, teacher, minister, doctor. I've decided to accept the call to be a Peace Corps volunteer. Thank you for understanding. So again, the idea, and when I talked to this person and asked them, they said, I just knew it was the thing I needed to do. They went to the Peace Corps, served for 2 years, came back, resumed their life, but were so much more enriched. And I have to tell you that the district was much more enriched having had that experience if they really could. And then finally, it's the environmental. This is where things in the environment kind of trigger things for you. It's like, you know, you're going to a meeting that you're wondering if I should really go to the meeting, and all of a sudden you have a flat tire, and you find out that you probably didn't need to go to the meeting. You needed to be someplace else. An electric outage happens. Your computer goes down. It's like it's a trigger. Maybe I should think about vacation here. Again, this is a story and a real life story here. A principal reported that she was most annoyed when late for a meeting. She was stopped for speeding, doing 42 and a 35, about a half mile from her school. While silently acknowledging that she'd been rightfully stopped for violating the speed limit, she was nonetheless embarrassed when she noticed a group of her students on their way to school walking in her direction. Peering in her rearview mirror, she noticed that the students, seeing the officer, ducked into an alley. After accepting the ticket and the admonishment from the police officer, she walked over to the alley only to discover a crowd of students egging on two of their members to fight. Her presence scattered the crowd and averted the impending confrontation. Later, one of the students involved in the fight asked her, "How did you know to be there?" And she replied, "I didn't know. It was a case of being in the right place at the right time and secretly for herself for the wrong reason." Well, I have to tell you, I had to go to traffic school on that one. But got out of paying the fine. Anyway. How did I know? How did I know to go back and check out the students? I mean, I'm sitting there in the car thinking, oh my goodness, the students are going to come up here. They're going to see Ms. Dyer sitting in the car. I had to ask the police officer, "Do you think you could turn the light off? I am here. I'm not going anywhere. Could you turn it off here?" So I'm thinking about the embarrassment. But it was seeing those students duck that I knew they weren't ducking just the police officer. It was more than that. So thinking about the story that you told, or any story, it could be another story. Think about any of these. Was it physical? The story that you told, was it about was it about the tingling or something physical or butterflies? It was about the aha all of a sudden. Was it emotional in terms of an instant like or an instantly being gravitating or being attracted to something else? Was it a feeling about something bigger, larger than yourself? Or was it about something that was in the environment, something that was there? So again, go back to your conversations and analyze or at least talk about the story that you told earlier in terms of any of these five levels of intuitive input, or if you decide you want to change your story, change your story. I'll check in with you in about 5 minutes. Go. So this whole idea about using intuition is not just something that is new age or it's kind of feel good. But we had Wes Agor, who did some research back in 86 around the logic of intuitive decision making, actually did a study with about 3,000 corporate executives. And what they found out is that when you ask them, do they ever use intuition, they said, yes, I use intuition when there's a high level of uncertainty. You know, I'm not sure exactly what's going on, so I trust my intuition. I trust my intuition when there isn't a whole bunch of precedent, that this is the first time that something like this has happened. When the variables are such that I can't really predict, or where the facts are limited, or the facts don't even indicate a direction to take, where there are lots of different solutions and all of them are plausible. All of them could be the right decision or the right solution, and I've got to go with files from the past. I have to go with environmental readings. When there's limited time and when the pressure is really high And when their negotiations and personnel decisions are really paramount, I have to be able to look at those and look at and be able to use intuition to help out. So this whole idea of intuition, you know, not, as I said, not New Age here, not the woo-woo thing here going on. What Jack and I have found, too, and it was interesting because as we've gone and looked at this later on, we've seen that these are just some of the type of behaviors that we see principals, leaders, others exhibit around this whole idea of being using intuition and being intuitive. Understand that they just can't be paralyzed by timing. Understand that sometimes it is about, you may have to make the decision quickly, but as Wes Agar showed, is that sometimes that's the best time to use the intuition there. And that they don't wait for a whole bunch of permission to act. They know that I've got to make decisions, and I can't wait for someone to give me permission and tell me that it's okay. They understand that it's about shared values. It's about understanding that it's about thinking about the common good and the whole. They recognize that once you violate trust, it is very, very hard to get back. And so, being able to put integrity up front and maintain integrity all the time. They also talk about what we know is that they're visionary, that they understand it's about sharing capacity, it's about the willingness to collaborate with others, and it's about being able to balance positional and personal power within the political realms of things that the political arenas that many of us have to face. The other thing that I've discovered as I've done more and more, and these are the handouts that I distributed at the beginning, is that intuitive leaders also understand the importance of being relational. They understand how important it is to understand that when it's all said and done, it really is about relationships. I think Edgar Schein talks about that the most important thing that leaders can do would be to shape and manage culture. Karen Dyer says one of the most important things that leaders can do are really shape and manage the perceptions around the things that are going on. Because when it's all said and done, it's not about what you said. It's not about what you did. It's not about what you didn't say. It's about what you didn't do. It's about people's perceptions of how they're being treated. And so it's very important that you understand that those are the things that are going on. If you look at the article that I gave you, there's an article that I wrote on relational leadership that really is about this whole idea of what's involved with being a relational leader. And the green is a, I think it's the, no, not the green, the yellow, is a 360-degree survey that I wrote for ASCD a few years ago around this whole notion of relational leadership and trying to get feedback and understanding what are the perceptions out there about me. And can't tell you how important it is. It doesn't matter if you don't choose to do anything about it, but it's important that you know what the perceptions are about you so that you can act, so that you won't be paralyzed, that you do understand shared values, that you are willing to collaborate with other folks. Some of you that have heard me before have heard this story, but I think it was my second principalship, and I had just finished my first year as the principal at the school. And I have to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, I had a good year. I mean, I had a real good year. I'm telling you, I was good. And I was so good that I decided that I was going to send out one of those sentiment surveys at the end of the year to all the staff members, because I wanted them to tell me how good I was as well. So, and so that I did. And I did it the way you're supposed to do it. You know how you're supposed to, give it to the teachers, and then another teacher collects it and then compiles it and gives you the data and everything like that. So, I mean, I did everything. So I'm sitting down with the teacher having gone through, and I'm going, yeah, I'm good. Yes, I rock. And so I came to, and everybody's kind of agreeing with what I thought I had done. And so, but I guess at that time I had about a staff of maybe about 65 teachers, and I had about 15, 16 responses in the survey that said that Karen plays favorites. Karen has favorites. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you probably don't know me really well, but let me tell you something that you can be assured. You can really be assured of this, and that is that I am extremely consistent and extremely fair in my relationships with other people. I mean, this is something I really pride myself on, being very consistent about that. So after I tried to get copies of the survey so I could check out the handwriting. Anyway. Okay. After I got over it. I went to another teacher. I said, you know, you need to explain this one to me. This would not be me. I mean, I know how fair I am. Well, I have had a policy, a practice, a norm that I've done, and I continue to do even today, and that is that I don't believe that you give people, everyone, the same equal piece of the pie. Because if you give everybody the same equal piece of the pie, nobody has anything to do anything of substance. So what I believe in is that if you come to me, tell me it is what you need, I'm going to give you as much of the pie that I can give you that will enable you to do something of substance. So that means in this case, you get it this year, but maybe you don't get it until next year, but be assured that you're going to get what it is that you need to be able to do something that really is going to make a difference. Well, this norm or practice or procedure or whatever you want to call it that I'd had, for some people, it appeared that it was unfair. So people that came to me and said, Karen, this is something I want, I tried to make sure that I could find the resources to give it to them. For somebody else, I would say, you know, I don't have it now, but let me get it the next time, but I'll try to give you the whole, as much as you can to make a difference, instead of just saying, these are the resources, I'm going to divide them by 65, and everybody gets, you know, a little sliver of the 65. So what I did at the beginning of the school year the next year, I went to every single teacher, explained my policy, practice, whatever, and told them this is how I operated. Some of them agreed with me. Some of them disagreed with me. Some of them knew about it. Some of them didn't know about it. Some didn't want to come to me. There were a lot of things that were going on. But at the end of the second year, when I did the sentiment survey, I was not as cocky, number one. But number two, this time I had about two or three responses that said, Karen plays favorite, Karen has favorites. Now, in this case, what I was dealing with is I was dealing with the perceptions that are out there. I wasn't necessarily changing how I did things. I was dealing with them, but it is very important to be mindful of the perceptions because, as I said, when it's all said and done, it doesn't matter what you said, what you meant, what you did, what you didn't mean. It matters how people perceive that. And as intuitive leaders, it's very important for you to be in tune with what are the perceptions that are out there. Again, shifting, I would like you to talk just a couple of minutes, again, with a story about perception, misperception, a time when perceptions may have gotten in the way, and then we'll come back and finish up and talking about the intuitive principle. But this piece about perception is very, very important. So take about, I'll give you about a whole 4 minutes this time. So go for it. All right, if we could come back. Want to talk about communication. This whole idea of being an intuitive leader and being one that really does understand the power of communication, I can't emphasize enough. How many of you, your perception of yourself is that you're a good listener? Okay, all right then. Okay. For the most part, most of us think that we're relatively good listeners. But in actuality, we probably aren't as good as we really think we are, because physiologically, we actually can't be. The average person speaks at about 200 words a minute. Some of us can do a little better than that. But anyway, about 200 words a minute. Most of us listen at four times that rate. So because we are listening and processing so much faster than the person is speaking, many of you have been back home while I've been talking. Some of you have been to the mall. You know, some of you have actually been to bed, woke up, came back. some of you have been back to class, back to work. But the thing is that I can't speak fast enough to keep up with the power of your ability to listen. So imagine then when you are talking with, speaking with someone who is of another language, as English is a second language, someone who tends to speak slowly, you know, someone who doesn't get to the point very quickly. So here you are saying that you're trying to listen to this one, and this especially can happen with parents, and with the, you being a an administrator, a lot of you, you've got the 180, 360 going on anyway, so your eyes are all over the place. And so here you are supposedly listening to someone, in actuality, you're going in and out. And so it's understanding the importance of that's going on. You can't do a whole bunch to speed up or your person speaking or to slow down your ability to listen, but recognize that that's going on. Listening also means that if you truly listen, you run the risk of being changed. If you truly listen to what someone's telling you, there's a possibility that they could say something that would be contrary to something that you really believe. So chances are that sometimes we may not want to listen because we don't want to run that risk.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that? I didn't catch that.
That was good. Didn't want to risk being changed there. So listening, very important. Writing. When it comes right down to, I think the main thing has to do with emails. And understanding that what happens, the power of email, in terms of what can happen when you're not attuned to what's happening to the other person on the other side. There are lots of conflicts that occur in the workplace and in personal lives because people aren't aware that what you said in a somewhat of a cryptic way, or your attempt at trying to be witty, you're not quite sure how the other person is receiving it on the other side. So it is being in tune. So when you get a response to an email, sometimes the response is based on not because the person is trying to tap dance in your last nerve, not because they are trying to be rude, not because they don't get it, is because how they perceived, how they received may not be the way that you intended. So not to say that email is not important. I use it all the time. More than I should sometimes, but being very clear that sometimes that happens. Being very mindful of body language and how body language can help and how it can get in the way. When I first got to the Center for Creative Leadership, I got feedback. Center's very big on feedback. Every time I turn around, I'm getting some feedback. Anyway, I got some feedback that said, Karen, you use body language to control situations. And my response was, and? You say that to say what? And they said, you use body language to control. And I said, yeah, I probably do. But what I hadn't realized is that here I had a strength using body language because I'm a former principal. I can't yell at everybody, so what do? I put one foot in front of the other. I fold my arms, I look over my glasses, I put my head from side to side, and then if they don't get it, I point. I mean, it works. Now, I don't think I was that bad at the Center for Creative Leadership, but what I had is I had a skill that it served me well in one area, a skill using body language, but that necessarily wasn't going to serve me in the new area. And being very attuned and being in tune, that Karen, you've got to be careful that you don't overplay or underplay skills. And that is the yellow sheet that I gave you, the very last sheet of that, is about looking at relational leadership skills, but being careful about overusing or underusing a particular skill. So while you may a skill has served you while you have been a classroom teacher, maybe as you move into the principalship, it may not serve you necessarily that way. Maybe you are in a leadership position right now in your school or your university, but if you transfer to another one, you may need to be very mindful of that. It's all about the communication, so being careful with body language. Silence is also something that is very important, and sometimes in terms of communication, silence is the thing that really is what's needed. This is another example from the book. A superintendent told a story about a particular trying board meeting where a principal was taken to task for an incident which had occurred on a student field trip. The principal had been vilified in the local press and beaten up by several parents and community members. The principal, superintendent, and the board president were aware that the true story needed to remain confidential so as to protect the rights of the students involved and their families. Even though the comments were harsh, the superintendent had communicated to the principal that issues of integrity needed to be maintained and that they needed to remain resolute. The superintendent recalls sitting in the auditorium after the meeting, she took notice of how some colleagues avoided the principal while others awkwardly offered, "Hang in there." Anyway, everyone had left, and the principal remembered sitting down next to the principal and for about 3 minutes exchanging no words between them. Then the superintendent got up, put her hand on the principal's shoulders and said, "Have a good evening." After the truth about the incident had been revealed and the principal's reputation was once more intact, the superintendent and the principal met to reflect on the incident, and the principal expressed appreciation of the silent companionship that he felt so supported, understood, and cared about. He asked the superintendent, "How did you know? I just needed you to just be there. I didn't need you to say anything. I just needed you to sit there." And the superintendent said, "I don't know. I just knew." Again, sometimes you just know. Last thing that we talk about in the book is this whole idea of contradictions of leadership. And some of these were referenced when we looked at Wes Agor's research. But that when you, there are some contradictions about knowing what to do, this is where intuition really comes into play. So is it about, you know, whether or not I'm a leader or a manager? Is it about, you know, am I going to be perceived as this autocrat, or are people just going to see me as someone that's really wishy-washy when it comes to decision making? You know, am I someone that's really facilitating the process, or I'm just somebody that just ends up standing in the way? Or is it somebody that, you know, that really is about I delegate? Or am I the person that it's really about being leader-centered? I'm the person people have to come to. They don't come to other folks. This is where intuition, too, can come into play, and knowing when and trusting those environmental readings and trusting those files from the past. So the last thing I want to talk about is this is something I came across a few years ago, and this whole thing about contradictions in the principalship, and I thought, well, you know, we just have a little fun here. So what I'm going to ask is I'm going to ask for this side of the room, you're going to read one paragraph, and this side of the room, you're going to read the other one. This is going to be audience participation part, you know. So I'm going to ask this side of the room if you would, I'm going to start, and then if you would read the paragraph. So I'm a new principal. Here I am at my new desk, which is loaded with guidelines and lists and policies. Everyone seems to know what I'm supposed to be doing but me. Then I discover that regardless of what action I take, I just can't please everyone. This side, I make quick decisions, I'm an autocrat. If I make deliberate decisions, I'm indecisive. That side of the room, if I call, I am. Over here.
If I correct teachers, I am picking on them. If I don't correct teachers, I am a weak administrator.
Over there.
If I speak up for new programs, I am on the reform bandwagon. If I'm cautious about changes, I am living in the past.
Over here.
If I attend community affairs, I am a politician. If I stay away, I have poor public relations.
Over there.
Decisions with the superintendent, I don't have a mind of my own. If I make my own decisions, I'm assuming too much authority.
goofy dog.
If I don't attend them, I am being unprofessional. When I'm walking around, I'm not getting my paperwork done. If I stay at my desk, I'm neglecting my staff and students.
Everybody, if I complain about these things, I'm a malcontent. If I can live with them, I am a principal. So that's what it's all about. And knowing, being the intuitive person, and knowing that, yes, these are going to be the contradictions that are going to be out there, but knowing that it's about files from the past, it's about being able to access and understand those responses that have to do with the physical and the emotional and the spiritual and the environmental, all of those things come together. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been a wonderful audience. I really appreciate you being here, and best wishes to you, and keep trusting your intuition. Thank you very much.
Karen just mentioned to me she'd be happy to take a few questions if you have any that you'd like to ask of her. We do have to get her to L.A. tonight because she's doing a workshop tomorrow in Los Angeles, but maybe a couple of questions?
Yes.
See, I actually have the principal voice, so, you know, I didn't need it. I think that that as a leader, you can trust people to have to rely on their intuition. But sometimes people's style is that I want the facts. You know, I want to know. I want you to be able to substantiate what it is that you've come up with. And sometimes people don't have the facts. And they aren't able to bring you the facts there that may have precipitated their decision. So I think that as a leader, understanding that sometimes people may bring to you their intuition, they may bring to you the big picture, they may bring to you a meaning, and trusting them and allowing them to be able to go with that. And I think that, you know, that acknowledges and honors that is a style there. But that's not always other people's style. Sometimes people just really believe that I really do need to be able to feel, to be able to touch it. If I can't touch it, feel it, mold it, then it may not be true. But I think that one of the things that we could do as leaders is to give people the opportunity to go with it. And one of the ways you give an opportunity to go with is use your own intuition and saying, you know, what are my files in the past? What are my environmental readings telling me about that person? So I think that might be something to do there. Yes. Yes. I think it was when I didn't quite know it, except that when someone brought to my attention, they kept asking me, how did you know that? I think the one that really resonated for me is I had an assistant principal come up to me one day, and she said, "Karen, why is it that when you tell that group of boys when you walked over there to take off their hats, why is it that they take off their hats when you tell them, but they don't take off their hats when I tell them?" And I said, "I don't know, because I told them." But when I really analyzed what it was that was the difference was that when I told them, I would walk up to them and say, "Young man, I want those hats off." And then what I would do is I would turn around and I would walk away. Now what would happen is that they would call me all those names that you know they call me. And they can say whatever they want to say about me as long as I don't hear it. So I allowed them to save face and say the things that they needed to say about me, and then I would walk away. When I got a certain distance, I did turn around to see if they had taken their hats off. And, yeah, they had taken their hats off and called me a name, but I didn't hear it. So when she told me that, and she said, "But how did you know that?" I said, "I don't know. I guess it's from experience. I don't know. I guess it's from experience." And so it's beginning to trust those things. So I think that that's, it was around that time that I began to say, it's okay to trust your intuition. Sometimes you just don't know how you know. The other thing I would tell assistant principals that I had is that when you're not sure what to do, always think about what's the best things for kids. And let that be the litmus test to decide whether or not you need to do it or not. So I guess, I don't know.
Did you keep a journal with you? Because I know that if you're ever brought to task on something by your employees or by a community to where they say, well, how did you decide to go? Just a feeling I have, just intuition. That may not stand with your community or with your employees. So a journal would provide you with experience. I've experienced this before at this time to where you might have a private journal and you could pull that information to support your decision if you're ever called to task.
Right. And I would say that not all my actions, nor would I suggest that all your actions need to be intuitive. I mean, there are things that, you know, that you do because the facts present themselves that you're going to do it. But there are times when there is ambiguity, when I'm not quite sure, when timing isn't crucial, that I would just go forward and the decision that I would be made would be based on that. Did I keep a journal? Have I kept journals? I know you're supposed to keep journals. You're supposed to really be reflecting in journals. I'm sorry, professors. I know you've been telling everybody to keep a journal. I'm really sorry, but I had trouble with the journal. But let me tell you what I'm really good at. I'm really good at keeping a calendar on my desk and writing notes on the calendar. And so I have these notes on all this other stuff. And so that's kind of sort of my journal. Okay, I know I was, all right, I'm sorry, you guys. I should have prepared that a better answer than that. My intuition tells me I should have had a better one. Any other questions? Well, thank you. Have an enjoyable evening. If anyone wants me to sign their book, I'll be more than happy to do that. Take care now. Bye-bye.